This is Polling Matters. My name is Kieran Pedley. We are less than 10 days away from the general election, and yet the outcome feels as harder to determine as ever. Labour have the advantage given the electoral math and the SNP's position of locking David Cameron out of Downing Street, but recent polls seem to be beginning to favour the Conservatives. Meanwhile, amongst pollsters, an intense debate rages about the importance of the differences between online and telephone polling. So what do we know, and how can we make sense of this all? Today I'm joined by Mike Smithson of Political Betting to help me make sense of everything. We'll be looking a little bit at what the work that he does, what the polls are saying, and then we'll also be taking some questions from social media. Mike, welcome to Polling Matters.
Good morning.
So I guess, Mike, one of the things that I ask most people who sort of are on this podcast during the election campaign is what their general impressions are, have been of the campaign so far, and has there been anything that surprised you?
I think what has surprised me quite a lot is that the performance of Miliband, I think I took the view that everybody else was taking, that he was going to be really quite smashed and exposed by the campaign, and that's not quite happened to the extent that people were thinking. And I thought the recent confrontation he had on the sofa with Andrew Marr with Boris Johnson was a very confident individual. And I think that is a major part of the campaign. Apart from that, I find the polls very surprising. I find the sort of divergence that we're seeing very hard to comprehend. And the other thing I find very surprising is that there are several academic groups now predicting seats, and they're producing very different projections. Mm. And trying to sort your way through all of that is quite difficult.
Mm. One of the big discussions amongst the polling industry at the moment, or within the polling industry at the moment, is this debate about phone versus online. Our previous episode sort of focused on this question specifically. I know Comrades have done a lot of work looking at this. I mean, what's your impression of that? I mean, do you think there is something going on there between where telephone polls are perhaps favouring the Conservatives more than online?
I think that if you look at the data, I think that's been shown that we find that online polls tend to produce better shares for UKIP. And that tends to have an impact on the Conservative share. So, and I think there might be an element that where you're talking to people, personally in a phone call, there might be less keen to mention that they are.
It's almost like a shy UKIP effect, potentially.
I think that might be there. Certainly, looking at the numbers, that's certainly happening, and there is a division. And that might be helping the Conservatives in the phone polls.
Mm. So that would imply then potentially that the online is more accurate. If people are not too shy to admit who they're going to vote for, maybe on the phone, then maybe actually our traditional conception, which is that telephone has historically been more accurate than online, might be challenged at this election.
It might be, but I've got my own question marks over online polling. The fact is that you're self-selecting, and I think that might make you different from the mass of the population who are going to be voting.
Mm.
So it is extremely difficult. I mean, I find it quite hard on my website that the number of people who will come on and say, oh, I've just filled in a Servation.
Mm.
And that you realise that quite a large proportion of a significant proportion of those polling panels are people with a above average interest in the political process. Mm. And again, are they representative? I don't know. I mean, I think what was really quite striking was after the first debate, the pollsters were asking, did you watch the debate? And they were producing figures like 38-40% of their panel said they watched the debate. Well, the official audience figures about a tenth of
Very different, yeah.
And that I think is an indicator that something is there is a question mark over online polling. But on the other hand, on phone polling, I live in a house, ultra marginal. Our house has been phoned 7 times by pollsters since the last general election, and that if it's random, the chances of that happening are completely.
It's almost ludicrous, isn't it? Yeah.
It's 40. It's millions by millions by millions by millions multiplied, and I just feel very awkward about that, and I'm not so sure. With the way that people use phones now, that we are getting the level of random samples that we used to get.
Absolutely, because I mean, traditionally the benefit of telephone polls is that it has supposed to be random, isn't it? Yeah. So, and actually, if that's no longer the case, then the sort of preference for phone over online, because phone is random and online is self-selecting, becomes a bit murkier, I think, doesn't it? Yeah. Let's talk about political betting. I mean, you know, people will know you obviously from the very successful site, but perhaps not know much of the backstory behind that and things like this. So I was wondering if you could briefly just sort of talk about how political betting came into being and maybe some of the interesting observations you've made over the years doing your work.
Well, it all came about by accident. I've been a long-standing gambler on politics, I like to talk about it. There's nothing more fun than finding somebody else who's a gambler. And during the 2004 American election, when the Democrats were choosing who the contender should be, one of them was called Kerry, John Kerry.
Yeah.
At the same time, and on Betfair, which used to have had a discussion forum, we were classified under novelty bets, I think. And at the same time, there was Pop Idol or one of those taking place.
Yeah.
And one of the contenders was called Kerry. And we had all the people from the Pop Idol people coming onto our discussions and really sort of driving us absolutely crazy. And I remember very well February 2004 thinking, this up with this, I will not put. So we bought the domain politicalbetting.com, and from then on I started it in the early days. This was pre Conservative Home. It was pre Guido Fawkes. There weren't many political blogs around at that stage. On the other hand, the level of internet usage was obviously far less than it was.
And Twitter and things like this as well.
But it took off pretty quickly. I think the idea that you're having a site that actually is trying to be less about policy, less about the yaboo, but more about trying to analyse numbers, trying to predict outcomes. I mean, I like to say, if we have a policy discussion, how is that going to impact? Is that actually going to have the sort of salience that perhaps people say it is?
Because it's very easy on comment sections of political websites for them to sort of descend into a slanging match, but it doesn't seem to happen.
We try to avoid it. We also try to moderate quite tightly to people who are, you know, not falling in line with what is, I think, the ethos of the site. We discourage them. And again, that's been one of the great parts of it. We've built up a very large, number of people who comment, and we get, thousands of comments a day, and that's I think adds to it. And I think it's what we do find is that people who come to political betting, the number of views they have it during the day, which we can monitor, is about five times higher than standard sites. People are coming, they're looking at discussions, they're reading, and then they're coming back again, which is all to the good.
Excellent. I mean, in the spirit of interaction, we've sort of asked for some questions from sort of listeners to the podcast, obviously knowing that you're on. So let's take a few. So somebody called Randall Northam, and if you're using fake names, people of Twitter, then I'm just going to read out what your name is in terms of your account, so, forgive me. But one of the questions he had, which I imagine you get a fair bit, is, are polls more accurate than bookies? And there seems to be differences of opinion here. Some people think that the opinion polls are there and that moves the markets. Some people that I've seen on social media would say, actually, follow the money. And that's where you know what's going to happen. I would, as a political bettor, I would imagine you would think follow the markets, but I think you're going to tell me something else.
I take a completely different view of that. If you had followed the markets on May the 6th, 2010, it opened the spread markets that Labour was going to get 320 seats, and the Tories were going to get, 220 seats, and the Tories were going to get 320 seats, so there was going to be a gap of 100 seats. In fact, as we all know, it turned out that the gap was 49 seats. Yeah. And I think that the Tories were being overestimated and Labour were being grossly underestimated. And, of course, that was reflecting a little bit from the polling. But if the theory that the markets know better was correct, then we wouldn't have seen that massive disparity. Mm-hmm. We saw it on the first debate. You had betting on what the... who would be deemed winner in the post-debate polls. And all the money was going on Nigel Farage. He was a very tight odds on favourite, and of course the winner of the on the polling was Nicola Sturgeon.
Mm.
So you would have thought that would have been perhaps a better indicator, given everything, but it isn't. So I'm not a. It always gets me very irritated when people say, "Oh, the money always gets it right." Well, it doesn't always. I think where it does get it right is when it's blindingly obvious. So, for instance, like the Scottish referendum. I mean, it was quite clear that the Scottish referendum was going to be tight, but the Scottish referendum was going to be won by no.
Yeah.
So to claim that the fact that the betting markets predicted that, well, it didn't really. It was just reflecting what was obvious.
Mm. So maybe it's follow the numbers in terms of the polls rather than the betting. But obviously, as I think you've made the sensible point several times, and you know I try to as well in some of the articles I write, the polls are actually quite hard to follow, not least because they're close and there's different numbers coming out, but actually because the national vote share only actually tells you so much. Like Lord Ashcroft calls it mood music, which might be a little bit unfair, but still I understand where he's coming from, because it doesn't tell you that relationship between votes and seats, does it? So we've got another question here from Chaiminda Jainetti. And again, if that's not your name, then apologies, but that's what your Twitter says. Do we need to shift to regional polling in the future, i.e. separate polls, not sub-breaks for London, Midlands, etc.? Now, we're already seeing a little bit of that, aren't we,
the polling industry stopped polling Northern Ireland when a different political environment emerged in Northern Ireland. So I think up to the sort of 1960s, the polls were all UK, so they cut off that. And I think that perhaps because we have a very different political environment in Scotland, there is a case for, at its very simplest, having England or England and Wales polling.
Mm.
And I think that gives you a different pointer. We are seeing quite regular polling, of course, in London. But that's partly because the media's based here, and the funding. And
you've got the Evening Standard, which obviously is naturally very interested in that specific demographic.
There have been odd regional polls in England, but not that many.
Mm-hmm.
Wales, which was 40 parliamentary seats, which is not a lot. They have a poll every 3 months, but from YouGov, which is interesting. But it's certainly giving you better data than looking at the subsets from the data that the pollsters produce. I would like to see more England and Wales polling, because that's the natural political environment in which we're operating.
And that's ultimately where most of the marginals are.
Yeah,
Scotland, of course, but actually where the election is going to be won and lost will be England, won't it?
Yeah, I think it's about 96 out of the top 100 most marginal seats. Labour con seats are in England, and that's the battleground.
Be interesting, I suppose, to see what Lord Ashcroft does in the future, won't it? Because actually, his constituency polling is really valuable. I'm sure we can all agree. I mean, what's your impression of the polling that he's released?
I think it's fantastic. I think he's done an absolutely brilliant job in providing us and helping us to understand this election far better. I mean, I've got my quibbles on methodology, but then I always have quibbles with everybody's methodology. I do think at this stage, before a general election, that naming candidates is important, because in many seats that would show up the impact of incumbency far more. He does ask a second question after the first voting question, thinking specifically about your constituency who and the candidate standing. But I think he needs to perhaps go further than that and name them, because I think the big question mark over this election is the impact of incumbency. And with the Tories defending 100 seats that they won last time, they should have a significant incumbency bonus.
Mm.
And that's not always showing in the Ashcroft polling.
And I suppose one of the things I would say is that you tend to get it, as you would expect, because it's very expensive. It's not a criticism of the man, but it tends to be in kind of dribs and drabs almost as well. Whereas if you really wanted to know what the snapshot was in the marginals, you'd get about, I don't know, 50 of them at once, wouldn't you? And then you could quite clearly see which way it's going.
Yeah,
whereas it's hard to know what okay, you've got a couple of polls in February, but you sort of extrapolate what's going on in December. And there are some of the models, I think, actually do try and do that, and they take what the Ashcroft poll said at you know, 6 months ago and then extrapolate from the national swing. But it's very difficult, isn't it? Let's talk about Scotland. There's a couple of questions coming on Scotland, as I guess we might expect, because it's so important to what's going to eventually happen. Nathan Matthew, and then someone called Tactical Voter SNP Out, which are not difficult to understand where their loyalties lie, if you like. Two concepts, really. One is about the kind of the likelihood of SNP voters to turn up in the numbers that they're saying they're going to. I will deal with that in a sec. And then also the impact of tactical voting. I mean, is there a risk in Scotland that maybe the SNP votes being overstated? I mean, clearly there's going to be a significant landslide towards the SNP, yeah. But could it be exaggerated?
I think it might be being exaggerated for the simple fact that the person suggests you're getting extraordinarily high self-certified certainty to vote. The pollsters, of course, ask, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how certain is it? And, you know, you tend to find that SNP voters have much more certain than Conservative, Labour or Liberal Democrat or UKIP. Now, will that actually happen? I mean, I remember very much in the referendum campaign where they were talking about the massive turnout, and yet we found in the sort of what is the SNP stronghold, according to the polling of Glasgow, that had about the lowest turnout anywhere in the referendum. So I'm not entirely convinced. There is another factor. I think that the unionist community in Scotland is feeling very threatened. That's certainly some of the messaging that's coming out. And I think that ironically that the SNP threat might well boost turnout amongst unionist supporting people, that the people who perhaps in normal circumstances wouldn't come out to vote.
What about the second point of tactical voting? Because I'm always, I mean, obviously tactical voting exists, but I'm always slightly dubious that Labour voters are going to suddenly vote Conservative, or Conservative voters are going to suddenly vote Labour to keep the SNP out.
I think that there's a lot in that. YouGov did some polling a week or so ago, trying to sort of get to the bottom of this, and found that Conservative voters were much more likely to vote for Labour where it was in Labour's SNP battles. Than Labour voters were prepared to vote for the Conservatives in SNP con battles. So that's an element. There has been some indication that with the Lib Dems, because Lib Dems have got 11 seats that they're defending, the Tories are just defending one seat in Scotland, and being the incumbent is possibly quite could be quite helpful. There are suggestions there that they might be being helped by tactical voting, and certainly you find of recent surveys the proportion of people in Scotland who say they're tactically voting who are voting Lib Dem is higher than for any of the other parties.
Yeah.
So, but again, it's small numbers, it's subsamples, and reaching any sort of firm conclusion from it is quite hard.
Sure. The almost overlooked point is that the SNP surge could get so big to an extent that it actually hurts the Conservatives. But I'm loathe to say more, because obviously Labour being wiped out in Scotland is huge for the party's future. But ultimately, the more Lib Dem seats the SNP takes, that actually hurts the Conservatives in terms of the numbers game for forming a government, doesn't it? Because actually the SNP have said they're going to lock Labour out. The final question we had was from Justin McKirk, which I think was for both of us, but was around who do you think is going to win most seats? I mean, that is a very, very... I mean, you know, put your money where your mouth is.
Well, I'm a gambler.
Yeah.
I try to assess the probabilities. Where a bet is better, offering odds which are better than my assessment of the possibilities, then that's a good bet.
Mm.
And at the moment, it's... the betting is 70 to 75% on the Conservatives' most seats, and 25-30% on Labour most seats. I think that's wrong. I think it's probably about 40-45 Labour, 55 Tory. What we really don't know is how the normal models of allocating seats are going to operate. Until this election, we've always talked about the uniform swing, the uniform national swing, and that's been a way of looking at it. And we find that in the sort of England and Wales polling that there's probably UNS of about 4 to 6% being showing, and that is and if the on 4% if it operated to UNS, then Labour will be comfortably home and dry on most seats.
Mm.
Because one of the things, of course, with this is that for every Labour gain in England from the Conservatives in terms of most seats, that offsets two losses in Scotland.
Yep.
This is not, because clearly the Conservative total declines by one and the Labour total increases by one.
Yeah.
So I think it's 55-45.
And presumably, when it comes to forming a government, it's even more favourable towards Ed Miliband at the moment, unless the polls are dramatically out. He's got more options in terms of how he forms a government, hasn't he?
It seems to be at the moment, yes. Though
a bit of hesitation in your voice there.
Yes, I think that you've seen statements from Clegg and the Lib Dems over the last few days, which sort of raise a doubt about whether they would be supportive of a broad government which was relying heavily on the SNP, I don't know whether that is just positioning in order that they can hold on to their as many seats as possible, or whether that is a true statement of what will happen. I find that quite amazing, simply because the Lib Dems of all would know that you don't have statements before the election could be hung on you after the election.
Yeah, there's a track record there, isn't there, I suppose. Thinking about the Liberal Democrats, actually, because, Nick Clegg's still alive and kicking for now, but they could still potentially have some choices to make, couldn't they, in terms of what they do? And I just wondered what your thoughts were in terms of what's it best in their interests, because to me, I was thinking about this the other day, and there's almost part of me that thinks, actually, if I'm a Labour Party strategist, I want the Liberal Democrats in government in some way with me, ideally in some sort of formal coalition, but we'll see what the SNP role in that is. Because ultimately, if I'm a Labour minority administration and the Lib Dems are off the leash there in Parliament, coming from a very low base of maybe single-digit national vote share, perhaps Clegg is out as leader, whether he's even in Parliament or not. There's a very easy path there to see how a Lib Dem recovery happens in terms of national polls. So, and that obviously would hurt Labour. Whereas if they're in government together in some fashion, then actually they share the blame in terms of some people on the left who maybe, let's say, don't see the cuts coming that maybe Labour would have to bring in anyway, even if they're not as bad as the Conservatives. So my kind of hypothesis is that actually it's probably better for the Lib Dems not to be in government at all. And actually sort of rebuild from the back benches, so to speak. But keen to get your thoughts.
I think they would be faced with the same dilemma as they were in 2010. Let's assume they lose half their seats. I mean, that seems to be the
reasonable assumption.
Yeah, say 27, 28. But that's still in the context of what's likely to happen post next Thursday, the week on Thursday, is still going to be quite significant. If they are seen to be blocking a stable government, that I think will be highly dangerous.
Mm.
I think a lot of it in relation to the party. I think the party would find it very difficult to go forward into a new coalition with the Conservatives. But if Nick Clegg is still there, and if Nick Clegg has saved half their seats, I think he'll be in a slightly stronger position than people think, and I think he would continue, and I think Clegg would probably enable a further coalition with the Conservatives to go forward. And the Conservatives would be absolutely desperate in any coalition to get the referendum. So effectively, their bargaining position
is much weaker. Yeah.
And I think the Lib Dems have learnt an enormous amount from coalition, and some of the things we don't talk about, but some of the structures, the internal way the coalition works, it was set up in a very bad way for the Lib Dems. Mm. But I think that if they went into it again, it wouldn't be policy so much as the structure and how decisions are taken.
Mm.
I could
maybe say, get their own department. That's one of the things.
I think
some
that's
people
one.
Have
I think that, I think that's possibly a good idea. But things could operate in a different manner. And for instance, when the coalition was formed 5 years ago, there was no support. The civil service machine supports the prime minister. There was nothing to support the deputy prime minister, the other party in government, and those sorts of things. I think would be sorted out in a better manner. But I think as well that there is concern about a Labour coalition because, they've seen what happened. I mean, as you were saying, that they're the ones who are sort of giving cover for the unpopular decisions. Mm. And that could be very damaging. On the other hand, I think that at the end of the day, they would find it very difficult not being part of something that would give stable government for the country.
Mm. And is there anything, not being an expert on the Liberal Democrat makeup in Parliament, is there anything about the type of seats that would be, the type of Liberal Democrats that would be left after this rout that they might get? So, for example, if they lose half their seats, are they losing a certain kind of Liberal Democrat MP that may be favourable or not favourable to them?
That's interesting. I think, one of the people most at risk, who was a very big doubter about the coalition in the first place, is Charles Kennedy.
Mm.
Who's had his obviously well-publicised problems, and I think that if he doesn't get back, that's another sort of influence of a restraining influence on Clegg, which would be taken away. I think that Clegg's position again. I'm not convinced he's going to win in Hallam.
Yeah, well, that's probably the main question, isn't it? Yeah. Is he actually going to still be there?
Yeah, which again is extremely interesting. If he isn't, what the procedure, as I understand it, is that the parliamentary party that's returned, they would immediately elect amongst themselves a deputy leader,
mm-hmm.
and that deputy leader would act as interim leader while a new leadership contest took place. And my instinct is that would probably go to Norman Lamb, a figure that a lot of people probably haven't heard of, but who's a very well-respected, he's very much a John Major type figure within the party, and I think he's probably got it with him, and I think he would, I think in terms of which way he would jump, he would jump whichever he felt was right. I think I could see him leading a coalition to the Conservatives and with Labour.
That was Polling Matters. My name is Kieran Pedley, and thanks again to my guest Mike Smithson today. Lots of interesting topics to think about there, not least where the Liberal Democrats go from here after the election. Next week we'll be putting our necks on the block and having one final podcast before Election Day, but do keep an eye out for several that we've lined up for the sort of post-mortem, if you like, and what happens next for the polling industry, of course, but also for politics in the UK. Thanks for listening.